thank you everybody for being here. On behalf of the Hellenic Observatory, I wish to welcome you in this the panel debate on the PSI in Greece. I wish I could say I'm very happy to host this event, but the times are not very, very pleasant for Greece, and this is quite critical a time for Greece. We expect any hour or any day now to hear news about the PSI and what the future is going to hold for Greece. Greece is in many respects in between two very negative options. On one hand, a very painful restructuring and the kind of permanent austerity. On the other hand, an all-out default and what would mean that in terms of impoverishment in the country and stability, political and economic as well. But at least I'm very pleased to have four very senior and distinguished experts on issues of debt restructuring, sovereign debt, who will speak in the debate today. And hopefully they will help us understand the why, the how, and the so what of the situation with the PSI deal, which we're expecting in time. Our first speaker, in the panel to speak, would be Dr. Zermin Zettelmeyer, who is a key expert on issues of country indebtedness and restructuring. He's deputy chief economist of the EBRD here in London, and he's worked for years at the IMF as a senior advisor to the research department of the IMF. He has done research and policy work on looking at sovereign debt crises across the world, and he's going to talk also about the implications of that experience for Greece. Our second speaker sitting on this side of the table, Dr. Rigo Olivares Caminal. He's at the Center of Commercial Law Studies at Queen Mary College, and he's a legal expert on sovereign debts and insolvency law. He has acted as advisor in various international organizations, including organizations that are very close to home when it comes to the Greek PSI. He will speak on the legal dimension and hopefully enlighten us about some of the things that the lay people, including myself, do not understand about all the terminology with the legalities of the PSI negotiations. Third, in our speakers, Dr. Andreas Koutras, a senior market analyst who has written extensively on the specific case of the Greek PSI and the sustainability of the restructuring arrangements and alternative proposals on how to make the restructuring sustainable. Andreas will speak, of course, on the PSI and the proposal he has put pretty much forward about combining repurchasing in the agreement. Last but not least, in respect, Dr. Nick Firouzi, he's managing director and head of European Rate Strategy at Nomura, one of the most important financial organizations institutions globally. He's written also widely on sovereign debt and the issue of PSI for Greece and the Eurozone more generally. And he's going to talk both about the PSI in Greece, but also the implications for the other peaks of the other problem countries in the Eurozone, what the future holds for Portugal and the other countries after the Greek PSI. I should emphasize that all speakers will speak on, all panelists will speak on individual capacity. They do not express in any way or form the views of the institutions to which they are affiliated. I have asked them to try to keep their presentations at 10, 12 minutes. We expect that they're gonna stay with this arrangement. And hopefully in the presentation, although each of the panelists will cover different aspects, I think we need to discuss the different questions that are prevalent for Greece today. What are the difficulties in establishing a PSI agreement? Who is to blame for the delays? Is the Eurozone a deal broker or a deal breaker? But also, second question, are there alternatives to the PSI? Is there a one-way solution or are there other arrangements that can help both the situation with the commitment of the private sector, but also the sustainability of the Greek debt? Will the PSI save Greece? Is this the solution, or is this the beginning of a very sour end? Does the PSI create more problems for the Eurozone at large through contagion? What does it mean for the other countries? And the very big question of what happens if we don't actually have a PSI, if all the discussions and negotiations about the PSI fail? What happens for Greece in the day after, but also for the Eurozone if Greece defaults? I think I said already too much. I'm sure you're interested much more than what our panelists have to say, so I'll stop here. And please join me in welcoming our four panelists who are going to talk to us today.
Thank you. it's a pleasure to be here. I'm only going to talk about a small subset of the many questions that Vasilis raised. And so my role on the panel, even though I have done a bit of work on specifically this Greek restructuring, my role on the panel is not that, but to give you a little bit of general background that will help you, I think, understand where there are problems here and where there are not problems. So I will give you some, basically, this work, yeah? So my approach is I'm going to give you sort of four key lessons from past sovereign debt restructurings. And by past restructurings, I mean mainly the experience since the Brady deals. And that's important because this is an experience based on bonded debt. So the modern history of bonded debt restructuring, which brings its own problems. And then I will just have two slides on what I think this implies for the Greek restructuring. Okay, so these are sort of my four lessons, and they look a bit abstract the way they're written down, but they will become clearer. So collective action problems are actually overrated in bonded debt. So the holdout problem in particular, which is a problem that Greece is struggling with right now, can be solved. Voluntary exchange offers are problematic. They sometimes work, but more often than not they don't, and they only work in special circumstances. Then there is an issue that has to do with the numbers that you hear tossed around. How much will the creditors really be hit, and how much does this imply in terms of debt relief for Greece? And the key here is that these concepts are not exactly the same. And then finally, the cost of default can be severe but are temporary, and they depend a lot on how the crisis is managed. So I'm going to essentially give you just one slide on each of these points. Point three, I think there'll have to be two, because it's a slightly complicated issue. Okay, so virtually all the debt restructurings that we have had since the mid-1990s, when there was this watershed in the modern history of sovereign debt, because basically sovereign debt returned from being largely based on bank loans, which had been the case since the Second World War, to being in the form of bonds. And so what the problem with that is that you had a very dispersed debt in the hands of many creditors. Obviously, there were some larger ones, some smaller ones. And the problem when you have that is that there's always an interest of the smaller creditors to free ride. In fact, of any creditor that is small relative to the total debt outstanding to free ride, any creditor that whose participation or non-participation does not per se scuttle the deal. Because of this problem, there were really widespread fears in the middle of the 1990s that restructuring this bonded debt would be an impossible task. As a result, there were lots of proposals starting in the mid-90s to have legal changes at the international level that would, in effect, establish something like a bankruptcy regime for countries in order to deal with these debt restructures in an orderly way. In the event, nothing of these changes really transpired. So the furthest we really got was in 2003, after the IMF made an attempt to have such a formalized bankruptcy regime for countries. The main progress was that collective action clauses, which is an attempt to deal with this holdout problem at the level of individual bonds, began to be introduced more systematically in bonds. But by that time, most of these restructurings that actually occurred in that period, most of these crises were over. And when you look back at what actually happened in this period, the record is remarkably good. So the fact is that most of these restructurings were completed pretty quickly, faster, in fact, than the bank debt restructurings from the 1980s. The holdout problem was really not much of an issue, so vast majority of creditors participated in these deals in the sense that they exchanged their bonds. There were a few holdouts, but litigation by these holdouts, for the most part, was not able to block any of these exchanges. In fact, there was no significant litigation with one important example, which is Argentina. But even there, the holdout, the exchange went forward in spite of this litigation. And so basically the interpretation that you can give for this is that there was, a spontaneous institution, a procedure, a way of dealing with these collective action problem that created itself or was created with the help of some lawyers, particularly on the side of the debtor. And this is the idea of a unilateral debt exchange offer combined with a minimum participation threshold. So it's basically conditional on enough other creditors taking that deal. And that is supposed to give you a reassurance as a creditor that if you are taking the offer and nobody else does, you're not going to be standing alone with this illiquid written down bond. And so, combined with some degree of coercion in the sense that you didn't ex ante promise to these holders that they would get repaid. So there was a significant risk not to get repaid, and the situation that you would have then had gone to go through to get your money was the legal track, which is a costly and uncertain track in sovereign debt. That combined with some good faith offer where creditors more or less were given what the country could pay led to essentially the successful resolution of most of these crises. Now note that during most of these episodes there were actually no collective action clauses. I think they were really used only in one or two cases, and even in those cases they were only acted in the background in a way that I will describe briefly, and that could also be done in Greece. Okay, the second lesson is this idea of voluntary debt exchanges. So none of these successful debt restructurings were voluntary. So it depends a little bit on what you define by voluntary. But so my preferred definition of voluntary is that you really take someone, look, no pressure, okay? So here's an offer. We think it's a reasonable offer. We think it corresponds to our ability to pay. But if you don't like this offer, we're going to continue repaying your old bond, okay? That's what I call voluntary. None of these successful exchanges were voluntary in this sense. Now, this is not to say that voluntary debt restructurings have never been tried. In fact, they have been tried, and we went with a co-author who knows more about this than anyone else. We went through virtually all distressed debt restructurings since 1970 to try and pick out the ones that, by this criterion, were voluntary, right? No pressure. And we got to about 20. Or maybe 16 if you don't count repeated offers. Now, it turns out I expected them to all be failures, but that's not the case. In fact, 11 of them were successes in the sense that they averted a default. They were not followed by subsequent hard restructuring or default. Five were failures. They led to defaults, and the two most famous voluntary attempts, which is an attempt in Russia in July of 1998, which was then followed by a terrible default in August, and famous Argentina mega swap in June of 2001, which was followed by a terrible default in December of the same year. They are among these famous cases. Now, even though these failures are the minority, the successful cases seem quite special. So in other words, these were relatively small operations. By far the largest voluntary restructuring was actually the Argentine mega swap, which involved about $29 billion US dollars. Much, much smaller than what's on the table in Greece now. But most importantly, these voluntary exchanges were for the most part just attempts to generate liquidity, right? to smooth payments into the future. And so it really contrasts a lot with the nature of the Greece PSI, which is also supposedly voluntary, because what the Greek PSI is really trying to do is more than just a voluntary restructuring. It's a voluntary restructuring of a certain kind. It's supposed to be very comprehensive, achieve very high creditor participation, and also achieve very high debt relief. And so I have a paper with a co-author from Duke where we argue that you can basically do two out of these three, but not all three. Logically, it's not possible. And I can discuss this a bit more if you want. Okay, third point is the distinction between haircuts and debt relief. So, this has to do with the mathematics of these restructurings. So most of these restructurings involve some combination of writing down promised payments and extending them into the future. Now, from the perspective of the creditor, what you are after in this restructuring, what concerns you is the value of the restructured bonds, right? How much they're valued in the market, given the sovereign risk that's prevailing in the market. And that value is the same thing as computing the net present value of these promised cash flows at the yield that prevails in the market after you restructure. And so in order to compute the loss, you have to, what you have to compare is the net present, is the you know, the net present value of the promised cash flow, the new cash flow, with the net present value of the old cash flow, the old bonds, and you have to compute them at the same yield. Now, the problem is that this yield after you come out of an exchange tends to be pretty high because there's still a lot of sovereign risk, right? So exit yields in the order of 20% are not unusual. And this tries to, in a situation where a lot of this, of the future payment obligations are shifted in the future, this implies a much bigger haircut, a much bigger loss than if you do the same operation at a lower interest rate, which is the borrowing rate in normal times. Now, from the perspective of a country, what you should be doing is doing this computation at this lower interest rate, because you do not want to establish your solvency, answer questions about your solvency based on, you know, the prospect that you yourself might default again in the future, right? You want to know that, conditional on things returning back to normal, you would be able to repay. And so this difference between the discount rates you apply gives you a dramatic difference in between debt relief and haircut. And unfortunately, it always works against the country or against the investor, if you like. So a given debt relief typically implies a higher haircut. And we've computed some examples from the famous past cases here. Now, what would happen in the case of Greece?
A couple of minutes.
So, under the nice thing about the case of Greece is that, given the type of offer that is on the table right now, which involves paying quite a lot of portion of the reduced face value up front, there isn't very much of this postponing into the future. And as a result, the net present value of the new debt is not very sensitive to differences in the discount rate. So these things are actually relatively close together. And so what I've done in this table is I'm giving you an example of what the this net present value debt reduction would actually be in the case of Greece, depending on these discount rate assumptions. So here, this is for an example which I think is realistic. I do not know whether this is the offer that's on the table right now, but it's probably close to what's on the table right now. This down here, oops, is the debt relief that Greece would receive. So it's a little more than the 50% nominal reduction. Okay. This back here is what it would look like from the perspective of investors. Not too far. It's about 60% haircut. So it's tougher, but not very much tougher because of the fact that you're not postponing much into the future. But unfortunately, there is a further complication, which is that the concept of the haircut that I'm using here is not what the creditors typically tend to use, which is this. So what the creditors typically do is, rather than comparing the net present value of the new and the old bonds, they compare the net present value of the old bonds to the face of the new bonds to the face value of the old bonds. And this tends to exaggerate the haircut. So this is probably where you get these outlandish claims that the offer on the table is in the order of 75% haircut rather than 50%. I imagine. I do not know for sure because I don't know what they actually discussed. Okay.
The last point in 1 minute.
Okay. Okay. The last point is easy, which is that, you know, the cost of default vary widely in this international experience. It's cost of default from the country's perspective, but they are temporary. They go away after a few years, and they depend a lot on how a restructuring is handled. Okay, so let me then come to the implications for Greece. This is a sort of general implication that you get out of the taking this all together. You want a comprehensive restructuring that achieves the debt relief needed, but not much more. It doesn't mean that you have to return to markets for some time, because that's when you get punished. But the market is definitely involuntary, is not voluntary. You do not want to promise a holdouts a free ride, and so forth. Now, what does this mean in the current situation? So basically, the way we are going to come out, this is my last slide, is there will probably be some sort of agreement with the creditor committee, maybe along the lines that I described in this slide. The big problem will then be to make the bondholders that were not part of the committee accept that agreement, and also to keep the discipline within the committee. And the temptation not to go along is going to be irresistible for those bondholders that have debt coming due in the very short term, right? Because for them, it's a matter of accepting a 50% face value reduction or getting repaid in full on March 20th. And so if the objective is to bail in those bondholders, there is just no alternative to getting away from the voluntariness principle. And probably the most effective way of doing it would be to the so-called retrofitting of a collective action clause. Now, the point that I'm making here, and I'm ending now, is that there may be a way of doing that where you do not actually have to use that clause, but you use it as a threat. And the idea here is that you make it clear, you basically, as creditors, exchange their bonds, right? Those that you have done the agreement with, hopefully you're going to get to the 75%, particularly if you take care of the ECB, to get to that crucial threshold where this clause could be used. And so you make it clear that if you are going to be above 75% participation, but below some desired threshold, like 95, you will use the clauses. You will actually ask these creditors to vote for the clauses. That threat should be credible, and as a result, no one would actually want to be left out of this, because the alternative is then if you're a holdout and the clause is invoked, you're going to end up with a Greek law debt instrument of the same payment terms as the foreign law debt instrument that you just refused in the exchange, and that's going to make it worse. So this is essentially the idea of how this can be approached. But there are many complications, legal complications, and I'm sure my fellow experts here will talk about them. Thanks.
Thank you, gentlemen. On this note, we're moving on with the legal... the legal aspects of sovereign debt restructuring, Rodrigo Caminal, please.
Good afternoon, thank you very much for the invitation. I always end up with a sour fortune of having to explain legal terms, usually in 10 minutes, some of which are difficult to explain, some of them are complex, arid and boring, and at the same time I need to keep the audience amused, because if not, the other speakers complain that people left the room. As a lawyer, I will start with three disclaimers. The first one is that opinions given are on a personal capacity. Secondly, I'm going to be extremely candid. I am Argentinian myself, so I have outlived a couple of crises. I've gone through this. And very mentally, because I seriously do not like Greece becoming the next Argentina, in the sense that if you follow some of the literature, you will realize that Argentina has become what is known as a serial defaulter. One that defaults every, I would say, a cycle of 10 years. Argentina defaulted in 1982, 1992, 2002. I see a pattern there. So that is the reason why I will express some ideas with great conviction, because I'm aiming to, or I hope that Greece can avoid that. And the last disclaimer, it is impossible to discuss about pure legal issues without touching indirectly economic, financial, political, and social aspects. It's such, what we are dealing with is of such a complex nature that it's very difficult to say what we should do. For example, if we put Greece, we temporarily move Greece to Africa, Asia, or Latin America, we would have already dealt with it following what has been done in many of the previous restructurings that Jeremy has been mentioning. We know how to do it by means of an exchange offer. What is an exchange offer? Basically, give me an old piece of paper and I will give you a new piece of paper. The only difference, usually they will have worth financial terms. But in a nutshell, that is what an exchange offer is. Well, just to set out the scene, I would like to start by saying that with some quotes that have been out there, the first one is the former Spanish finance minister, Spain is not Greece. The response to this, or in addition to this, on The Economist, it was reported, Portugal is not Greece. then Irish Finance Minister saying Ireland is not in Greek territory. So apparently nobody wants to be Greek. But here comes the cavalry. Greece, the response did not last much, and it was on November 2010 saying Greece is not Ireland. Then Elena Salgado again, Spain is neither Ireland nor Portugal. And then, can I? Do you mind if I go there? Then Angel Gurria from the OECD saying, neither Spain nor Portugal is Greece. So this kind of sets the situation in which we are at the moment. But this becomes massive when you can bet online who is going to receive the next EU bailout, or is Greece going to default on sovereign debt, or is Portugal going to default on sovereign debt? But this is when it becomes really massive, high stream, when you can even find it in Playboy. Of course, I've been directed to this article because as a researcher, I usually use other type of sources. Basically, I've been asked to set out a framework of where we are to understand some of the issues. When we are dealing with sovereign debt, mainly there are two types of documents. One is a loan, technically IMF assistance is not a loan, but they usually refer as a loan, or bonds. Bonds that are provided by private investors, which is known as private sector debt, which is part of what we are discussing tonight about the PSI, and then the loans are usually provided either by international financial institutions or on a bilateral basis, that means country to country. And this is what is known as official lending. Upon an event of default or a distressed scenario, the dynamics of this is not as smooth as we think, and we're experiencing that to a certain extent now as to what is the role of official lending and private lending and who should get a haircut, if anyone should get a haircut. This is another way of looking at the same, which is these are the three types of debt, bilateral, multilateral, and private. And what we have to bear in mind is that there are two axes. On one, we have borrowers and lenders' perspective, that of course borrowers would like to get the biggest haircut that will help them go back into a sustainable path, while lenders, creditors, would like to not to receive a haircut at all. And also, we have to do an ex ante and ex post analysis, and that's something that, again, that has been to a certain extent discussed in the media as to whether the debt should be repaid, whether the debt is legal, whether it is legitimate, whether it is odious, and all this terminology, which is a lot of the jargon that is used out there to refer to this type of financing. In a nutshell, if you ask me, is Greek bankrupt? The answer, no. I see people in the audience saying, nodding like saying yes. The answer is outright no. Greece is not bankrupt. Why? Because from a legal point of view, there's no insolvency regime that applies to Greece. Therefore, Greece cannot be bankrupt. Can be in a situation of distress. It can be in a financial condition of insolvency. But technically, Greece is not bankrupt, nor will go bankrupt. I don't want to start discussing things that many of you might dislike, but the reality is, in the worst-case scenario, if we do an asset balance test, Greece has more assets than debts. Of course, I'm not suggesting that you should grant a concession on the Parthenon or you should sell an island. But from a theoretical point of view, that has happened in the past in the US with the state of Louisiana, with the state of Alaska, and therefore Greece has more assets than debt. Technically, Greece cannot be insolvent. So since we do not have an insolvency regime to deal with the current situation, what do we have? And in a nutshell, this is all what we got. We have the almighty IMF overseeing everything from above, the markets in the background, and then in the front, we have the three main players. The sovereign, the creditor who has lost everything and holds a piece of paper that says, I owe you, which is the piece of paper that I told you, give me your old bond, I will give you a new bond. And the guy with a cigar and a pinstripe suit that represents the banker. These three players have mainly two options, which are in this first sample, which is enter into restructuring or following the path of litigation. Following the path of litigation will assure you, highly likely, a federal court ruling that you will be entitled to recover 100% of your claim. Don't get excited so easily, because you will get the ruling, but a completely different thing is being able to enforce that ruling. Most of the assets that sovereigns have abroad are protected in one way or another. Payments to or from international organizations are protected by treaty. Embassies and consulates are protected by treaties. Military assets are protected by treaties. Central bank reserves are protected by treaties. So at the end of the day, highly likely you will end up having a federal ruling, but it will be very difficult to enforce it. So if we follow the path of restructuring, there are many possible options, and they are highlighted in the maze there. Since I don't have more than 10, 12 minutes to cover them, I will leave some of them for the open discussion. But mainly what I will say is there are many different options there, and this is where I slightly disagree with Jeremy. We have this discussion in Athens 2 weeks ago about the voluntary restructuring. And I think that as long as this technique is the restructuring, I mean the exchange offer, is combined with a contractual technique that will allow you to enhance the degree of participation, from a contractual point of view, it will be voluntary. It might be considered a credit event and as such might trigger CDS, but in my personal view, that is still voluntary. If I have a contract that allows me, that has a clause that allows me to amend the terms of the bonds by a given majority, if I manage to reach that majority and I happen to be the dissenting minority, I have no other option than to abide by what the majority has decided. Those were the rules at the beginning of the game, and those are the rules that I abide to play by. Like that, there are other techniques that I receive a haircut. Okay, I negotiated. Please, don't negotiate on behalf of Greece with the PSI, because now I got 3 minutes left. So basically what I was saying is there are other techniques, like for instance, exit consent. Once you have agreed to exchange your, give in your old piece of paper, you also grant a permission to the sovereign to represent you in the event that they call a bondholders meeting. If that happens, and they manage to reach the given majority, but not one enough to trigger, for example, the use of collective action clauses, you will be able to amend other terms that do not require a supermajority. Like, for instance, you will delist the bonds. You will, for example, change the governing law from the law of England to the laws of Argentina. And these are the things that will make the bonds less attractive, and to a certain extent you will be forcing the bondholders to exchange. But if you are forcing it, it's not voluntarily. Yes, you are forcing it, but you are not obliging them. They are the ones that will say, okay, I can end up with a useless piece of paper, or voluntarily I will agree. You are giving a big hand to make it borderline, but it's still voluntary. These are some figures of exchange offers where, by the use of additional techniques, you manage to increase the degree of participation, and all of them are about 90%. The only kind of blurry case is Argentina, where they have to reopen the exchange offer. There are some elements that you can argue was the most complex in history, because there were 152 different series of bonds governed by 8 different laws with more than 700,000 creditors scattered all around the globe. And on top of that, Argentina took a very aggressive line saying, okay, I'm going for a 92% haircut after 3 years of non-negotiations because they didn't bother to speak with creditors. So it is understandable that the degree of participation in the first exchange was 76. So I'm going to skip this one because this more or less reflects in a different way the cartoon. This is what we have at the moment, where we have created the EFSF and now the ESM, but in theory these two institutions, one a private company, the other one a subject of international public law, they are to provide liquidity, but I'm a little bit skeptical about their capability of solving the underlying structural problems. And basically, I would like to finish with this slide, discussing about some of the myths out there about sovereign debt restructuring, particularly because there has been a lot of confusion out there. The first one is, countries can be insolvent. No, they can be in a serious situation of distress, but technically they cannot be insolvent. A restructuring implies a default. No, not necessarily from a contractual point of view. It might trigger a credit event, and that will trigger CDS, but technically that's not a default. And this brings us to the definition of, yeah, but what if a credit rating agency says that Greece is a selective default? Okay, that is what a credit rating agency says, that is a selective default. That will be terribly bad because you will not be able to use that as a collateral for repo with the ECB, but technically, on a contractual nature, that's not an event of default. Would a restructuring trigger a CDS? Again, if it's done in a voluntary manner, no, that will not trigger a CDS. False. After default, a country cannot reaccess the capital markets. Unfortunately, false again. The case of Uruguay. Uruguay did a debt reprofiling in 2003, and they managed to reaccess the capital markets in just 30 days. Days or months? No, days. 30 days they were back in the capital markets. On the other extreme, you have Argentina still litigating all over the globe, still having paid out the Paris Club. They defaulted in 2001 and they still have not been able to reaccess the capital markets, except allocating debt to their cousins in Venezuela. I'm on negative. Three more bullet points on this slide and I'm out of here. The euro area member states can leave the euro. Technically, they cannot leave the euro without leaving the EU. That is the theory. However, on the practical side, if there's an agreement of will among the signatories, yes, they can leave, because a treaty is a contract. If you have the will to amend the contract, they can. Some of the debts of Greece, Portugal, or Ireland are odious debts. False again, they're no odious. For those debts to be odious, that's a principle of public international law, and for that you are missing one of the biggest requirements, which is the country needs to cease to exist as such. I mean, for example, in the case of the former Soviet Union, that would have been a case where you could have claimed that there was odious because it split in new countries. Better funds are bad. No, not necessarily. They provide liquidity, and they provide a value for an asset. When you need it. And the last one is on the pari passu clause, but I think that we don't have time to explain it, so we leave it there. EFSF does not have priority.
Okay, I'm sure we'll come back to some of these issues later on in the discussion.
I'll stand up. Hopefully I will be at least half as entertaining as my previous speaker. But unfortunately, what I will do is that I will describe the PSI in some more detail. Okay. Let me just give you a brief introduction. I want to use my 15 minutes to describe the PSI and the issues and the problems associated with it. And then I will go on and produce another alternative offer on the PSI, which I think is much better, and it should be quickly adopted by all member states or by all the stakeholders. Now, any restructuring aims at mainly three things. The first one is the exit yield. In other words, the yield that the country would access the market after the restructuring, after the debt has been reduced. The next one is the exit rating, in other words, the rating that would be given by the agencies to the country, again, after the restructuring. Currently, Greece is right at the bottom. If they reduce their debt, then it should go back up. And the last one should be the sustainability and the serviceability of the debt after the restructuring. How able would be, Greece would be to pay its debts, or its the newly structurally debts after the restructuring. Punishment of bondholders is never one of the issues and should never be one of the aims of any restructuring. In fact, it's quite bad. Markets punish far more efficiently and severely bondholders than any government degree. So one comment on these three main aims is that, unfortunately, in my opinion, the PSI and the PSI Plus does not fulfill these aims. And let me tell you why. This is the PSI enigma. It's actually a German enigma, for those who follow the story. I mean, this is the enigma machine from the Second World War. Now, Germany rightly insisted on the private sector involvement of any restructuring. This is correct and should be it should be done in every restructuring. However, it did something strange. It asked to be voluntary. So, and here's the problem. If you haircut too little, then there is no benefit to Greece from the debt restructuring or from the debt reduction point of view. If, on the other hand, the haircut is too big or too large, then the voluntary character is lost, and then you have a problem of holdouts, and then you might want to introduce retroactively retrofitting collective action clauses. The problem in Greece is that you also have the ECB, which is the largest bondholder with more than 20, well, almost 20% of the total outstanding bonds, saying that does not want to participate on a voluntary basis. So, and this creates what is called the free riding problem. Everyone wants to sit out on right next to the ECB, saying if the ECB is going to sit out on a voluntary basis, going to get paid 45 billion, why not me with my 10 million or 20 million? Okay. The next problem is that many Eurozone politicians insisted on a non-default of Greece. In other words, they told the bondholders, you are going to voluntarily participate in a debt restructuring. However, we're not going to force you, and we're not going to default afterwards. And by the way, the ECB would be paid. This does not help the participation. And of course, the last point is the sustainability. If Greece is, you know, does not complete the PSI, then why go into the PSI? Because you're going to get restructured anyway, if you go or if you don't. So there is no incentive. So this is the German enigma. Find a way to increase the participation in the PSI while keeping the voluntary character in order to first avoid default and then avoid the ECB having losses that might trigger capital increases and the ECB losing credibility. Okay? On top of the ECB being, on top of the German enigma, there is also an ECB Gordian knot. Why is that? Because the ECB owns outright around 45 billion of Greek debt, and apparently the average purchase price is around 80. Now, if they write down this debt, either through a PSI or in any other debt restructuring, coercively or not, it would actually eat up most of its equity, which is about 10.8 billion. Now, this is not good, okay, because the voluntary participation would cause losses of about 15 to 20 billion. So the ECB may need to be recapitalized from taxpayers' money, which would come from the national central banks. Politically, this is not nice. So the ECB said, I am a preferred creditor, and I'm not going to take a part into this voluntary restructuring. And even if they do restructure, I'm a preferred creditor. No. The ECB was never a creditor of Greece. The ECB never actually gave money to Greece. The IMF did, but the ECB never gave money. The ECB is a bondholder. The ECB bought bonds in the secondary market. And there is no such thing, there's no concept of a preferred bondholder. Why is the ECB a preferred bondholder and not my mother who bought the bonds for her pension? Okay? So there is no such thing. Now, everybody's talking about collective action clauses. And ECB said, we're not going to participate. Collective action clauses are called collective because they're binding for everyone. Okay, so you cannot have collective action clauses, but excuse me, this certain class of investors, of bondholders, are not going to participate. This would create even more problems. Okay, so this is the Gordian knot, and we're waiting for the Master Jedi, Mr. Draghi, with a lightsaber to actually cut that Gordian knot anytime now. I'm pretty sure that this is going to happen. Now, let me briefly describe you the PSI in its current form. There are about 355 billion worth of Greek debt. Out of this 355, 260 is in the form of bonds. The other one is just loans. Now, 260 billion is 242 billion under Greek law and about 18 billion under English or foreign non-domestic law. There are about 8 billion which are exempt for reasons unknown, and there are about 45 billion, this black diamond over there, 45 billion, which are not going to be part of it. So if you divide the rest, what happens is that on a nominal basis, you're going to have about 102 billion debt as a relief. And you would end up, again, on a nominal basis, at the end of the exercise, assuming 100% PSI, with about 242 billion or 110% of the GDP. And of course, then you have to service this 242 billion from the first day, including repay these 45 billion if the ECB does not participate. Now, this clearly is an unsustainable solution, no matter what, even with 100% PSI. You cannot actually service this debt day one, even with a very low coupon. Okay. Now, what is the alternative PSI? Well, the alternative PSI, which I proposed some time ago, was very simple. First of all, you need to take the ECB out. Why? For a very good reason. The ECB creates the free riding problem and the holding out problem. Everybody sits out waiting for the ECB to be paid and for them to be paid. So it's very simple. Take the ECB out at cost. What was the cost? 80% of 45 billion, that's 36 billion. Borrow the 36 billion and take the ECB out. The next is to actually try and get the other aims of exit yield and exit rating. And what I'm saying is that add the option of a cash payout to destroy the bonds. Currently, the PSI says, give me your old bonds and I will give you back a new bond of 20 years maturity or 30 years maturity plus some cash. I'm saying add also a cash out. In other words, pay 30 and give me the bonds so I can destroy them. Why is that? Because, first of all, if you take the ECB out, then you constrain the free riding incentives and you limit the holdouts. The holdouts would only be the ones who are going to have foreign law. In other words, about 18 billion or 6.9% of the total bond outstanding bonds. Or if you have near-term bonds like the March 12. If you want to stay out for longer maturities, it would be very risky. You would be left with a Greek law bond out in the dark, out all alone. The cash offer helps the exit yield and pushes the exit rating up. And this is the dynamics of it. You start with 260 billion, you pay the ECB 36 billion, you assume about 10% of holdouts, so you have about 20 billion, you pay 30 cents to about 80% of the rest, so you have 50 billion. You expect some people to stay with the bond offer, in other words, to take the new bonds, about 10%. You have another 10 billion, you add the 8, which was excluded, and then and the loans, and you end up with about 220 billion day one, or 100% of the GDP. Okay, now this is a much better offer for a very simple reason. Because Greece cleans up the majority of its bond stock. Okay, there are no bonds, or there are very few bonds left. You drop to the GDP of about 100% from day one, not in 2020. Of course, you then go up because you have to service that debt. But at least it's a much lower starting point. As the loans have a 10-year grace period, you have an exit rating which is going to be much higher than before as the outstanding debt is reduced. And also, the sustainability of the Greek finances is improved. the loans have a coupon of 3.5, and on top of that, because they are bilateral loans with the official sector, it's much easier to restructure should Greece come, has a problem again in 1 or 2 years' time. You also limit the introduction of English law in new bonds, and you also minimize the risk of lengthy and costly litigations. The most important thing, however, is that it places a firm backstop on the Greek debt problem for at least 10 years. And what happens is that you try to reverse the extremely bad investment environment and halt the depression in both the economy and in the society. You actually put a backstop. You destroy all the bonds, or the majority of the bonds. You now have official sector loans, and you do have a serviceable debt. Why would the bondholders do such thing? Well, why would they accept the 30 cents instead of a 20-year bond? I think it should be clear to everyone that if I'm a bondholder who has a bond, who has a Greek bond, I'd be much rather take 30 cents and out rather than have to manage a 20 or a 30-year Greek risk and the risk of being restructured once more if the sustainability is not there. And, think of bondholders who actually had a duration of 2 years and now they are forced to take a duration of 20 or 30-year bonds. I mean, this was never part of their investment portfolio. They would much rather accept 30 cents. After all, right now, most of the bonds are trading between 20 and 30. I'm offering a premium as well. I mean, I'm generous Greek. Okay, and on top of that, as a bank, you don't have the regulatory charges from Basel III that would come into play on a 20 or 30 year bond. And what are the advantages of Europe? Well, the proposal operates within the framework of the EU Council decisions because it is a voluntary PSI proposal. I'm just adding an extra option alongside the bond. The ECB would be needing no capital because you take it out at cost. So there's no problem there. And Europe does not need to worry, or let's say mostly worry, about the Greek debt problem for the next 10 years. And you avoid also the disorderly default. Now, this is, in short, the proposal that was made. And it was kindly published by the Greek Economists for Reform and also by the LSE some time ago. I have a feeling that at least the first part is going to be implemented very soon. In other words, the ECB would, in one form or another, take part into the PSI. And I would leave you with the poker game that's been played right now on the Greek PSI. You have all the top dogs on the table playing poker about whether they're going to introduce CACs or not. My personal view is that CACs should not be introduced, should not be activated. Introducing is one thing, activating is another one, because this is a cowboy behavior and it's not consistent with a European country, never mind about Greece. So, you cannot change the laws to fit your views every time. So with that, I leave you because I have a few more slides, but my time has run out and I'm actually quite pleased because I timed it exactly 15 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we'll revisit because the whole idea depends on how to fund the results.
Because that's the other one.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, moving on very quickly to the last
presentation and the issues that we can come back to, but I think it is also the question of the implications more widely for the Eurozone, and Nick is going to talk about that.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to, I've actually quite a lot of slides. We're going to go over them very, very quickly because, I have to first of all credit my two of my colleagues who are here in the audience, Dimitris Strakopoulos and Alex Howell. I've shamelessly ripped off their slides, but I will try to give you quite a different view on it than they usually do because they tend to be, they know all the technical details of the PSI itself. Whereas I've been coming in and being a fair amount older, I've turned off. It's an incredibly boring situation at this point in time, and it's hard to follow. Oops, I'm sorry. I just obviously I didn't know what to. Oops.
Mm-hmm.
I want to follow through on a point that Rodrigo made, that in particular, if Greece were somewhere in Africa, we would have dealt with this long ago. And in particular, that a lot of the choices that are being made in terms of the PSI and in terms of the ultimate sustainability of the debt have to do with the fact that it's part of Europe and that we're looking at it from a contagion point of view. Many of the things you've heard about today, collective action clauses and so on, they're purely optional. And they're meant only because we have to think about the Greek PSI in terms of the possibility of future PSIs in Portugal and Ireland. So, in terms of the restructuring risk, we see that Greece is actually undergoing this PSI and in the midst of national elections with the possibility of a hung parliament thereafter. So we have a number of things that we have to implement in the coming terms in terms of the structural reforms. It's not clear exactly how well that will go, but while this is going on, Portugal is just in need of renegotiating the package because they will not have enough funding as of September of this year. They need at least 12 months of funding for the IMF to continue disbursements. And just because of that, we have the shadow of a possible Portuguese restructuring hanging over this Greek restructuring. And the markets have just now tuned into that, partly due to a recent downgrade. Portugal dropped out of some indices, and suddenly it sold off massively. It was just in the past week. And without a credible offer of further aid to draw a line in the sand, it's likely that they will have to undergo a restructuring as well. Ireland, of course, there's a possibility of contagion there, whereas the Irish, it's not just the markets looking at contagion, it's also the voters. The voters themselves see if Portugal gets a good deal, why don't we? And the possibility of referenda looming in Ireland, it's all the more likely for it to be a popular measure for the government to threaten a referendum unless the EU treats them also well. Let's see. This one. There we go. Well, I'm going to give you a bunch of slides. These are from Demetrios. A bunch of slides about the ongoing restructuring, but they're all macroeconomic projections, and I'm going to just give you a couple takeaways. You could go through lots of details on this, but the fact of the matter is the estimates have gotten worse. The IMF estimate of the GDP forecasts are in the dark red from July. They've gotten worse as of October, and they're probably going to get worse yet. So they all go one direction. Again, the primary balance forecasts are rather generous. They thought they could maintain a very high level of primary balance thereafter, maintaining debt sustainability. That was as of July. The IMF may have been pressured into this, but the key lesson here is all of these forecasts have gotten worse. And similarly, the privatization revenues. The IMF and the EU have looked into privatization as means of dealing with this debt sustainability problem. They have gotten worse yet again because there's no way to privatize at this point in time. So while the forecast for debt sustainability, and our numbers are quite different from Andreas's numbers in terms of the total debt stock, but the previous assumptions as of July, we see that the red line was number one on the right-hand side there. It's gotten worse. According to the revised assumptions, even with near universal participation, if the ECB is not involved. So as a consequence, everyone is pushing for the ECB to be involved, except the ECB itself. Now, the IMF would like the ECB involved, and there are different scenarios here. One is that they're paid off, which means they're treated differently from all bondholders. This is actually, even in and of itself, it's a bad signal to the markets. Why should one bondholder be preferred? It's bad enough the ECB can hold out because it's just not done. You can't hold out when you're a bondholder. You can hold out if you have the same ISINs, the same bonds as every other counterparty, why should you be treated differently? There are legal workarounds. It's legal, but it's questionable as to whether it's ethical. And then we also have revised assumptions, much better assumptions, where there's universal participation from CACs, including the ECB, who participates like everyone else. Now, the timeline is very complicated. We can't really go into these details. Again, there's a couple takeaways here. Is that one of the takeaways is that the only reason why they're introducing CACs or collective action clauses are effectively voting rights for bonds. Now, Greece can unilaterally restructure its debt. Tomorrow could say, oh, suddenly we reduce the debt costs by 50%. And there's nothing bondholders can do about it. Well, they can challenge it. There will be legal challenges. You have to take them up in Greek courts. They're not going to do that because that so-called nuclear option seems it's too scary for every other market around, because so could Portugal, so could Ireland, so could Germany itself. Everyone can reduce its debt just by act of parliament. Instead, they will, by act of parliament, put in these voting rights into bonds. And I liken the vote that they're going to take place as like a vote in North Korea. We know what the outcome is going to be. And they're not going to design the collective action clauses unless they know what the outcome is going to be. But they put it in there just to make it appear that it's, at least most people want to go along with it. We've heard that it could be as soon as next week that they retrofit them in the bonds. And just as a means of potentially threatening further participation. Now, so as we point out, all of these issues affect the ultimate sustainability of Greece. And it's only because we're thinking of it not just as a repeat game. Most debt sustainability problems are a repeat game because the sovereign has to go back to the market once again. It's not just this sovereign that we care about. It's the other sovereigns. And the way the ECB acts in this game matters, because ECB has bought a significant portion of Portuguese debt. The EU has loaned significant funds to Portugal, similar for Ireland. And the question is, what is left for bondholders? And should bondholders just be dumping everything like mad, just because of this, because they don't believe they'll be treated fairly? So as I said, there's just a tremendous amount. This is basically a view on the things that one should look for, and the externalities that in terms of the adjustments. Sorry, actually, I'm not really going to cover this. There's too much to cover. The main issue I'm going to cover is the subordination issue. The fact that by the ECB entering in large size, the EU entering in large size, it makes the losses on the bondholders that much greater. Had they haircut the debt more than a year ago, it would have been a much more acceptable loss for bondholders. Now, another set of charts. Again, a similar message. We have Portugal, first IMF review, second IMF review, and what's likely to happen the next time around. Getting worse. Not quite as bad as Greece, but at the same time, it's getting worse. And Portugal, in terms of debt sustainability, now it's possible that when in September, when they talk about new packages, the EU decides to draw a line in the sand. This is it. It's a very expensive thing to do, to take Portugal out of the market, say until 2020. Here we estimate $233 billion extra. I mean, part of it's undisbursed from the original package, but $233 billion of loans to Portugal from the official sector. That is something the Northern European voters will potentially balk at. Now, it's cheaper to try to push the can down the road and have an option. And some people, clients of ours, for instance, have thought about the possibility, why don't we just take them out for 2 years, say about $30 billion. Take Portugal out for 2 years and work on the terms of a fiscal union, because obviously we do not have one right now. We're not moving that quickly towards it at this point in time. The quicker the resolution, the better the terms would be for the bondholders, because as time goes on, they get more and more subordinated, and that's the chart on the right. Okay, now I have a lot more to do, so I'm just going to skip ahead, but we think this possibility of contagion is quite serious, and Just to touch on some of the other things that are involved in what's working in the EU, is the rescue packages. Rescue packages, essentially, you could say, because they're designed by politicians, they're designed not to work. And they're designed to give actually exactly the wrong signals. Now, the rescue packages themselves were never big enough. And they've had to revise them from EFSF 1.0 to 2.0. We know what kind of trouble that involved. 17 parliaments passing legislation. Still, they're not big enough. As a view on how much on how they are not big enough, Alex has done here a list of the guarantees and what's been committed. The total that's left to leverage or disperse is only $258 billion after you look at all the commitments. That's why we start to look at leverage options just to gain the credibility. There's either we have to increase the size, pass it through 17 more parliaments, increase the IMF bailouts, which I'm questionable as to whether that's feasible, or we have to look at leverage. And the leverage itself is basically, here I'm going to give you a very complicated chart, but there are two leverage options that they've discussed in some detail. Neither of these is workable, primarily because the politicians have been involved. I can explain them, but I'm running out of time now. We're venturing into the fact that we're trying to introduce the ESM, the European Stabilization Mechanism or Stability Mechanism. That's supposed to take place in 2013. Will only be marginally bigger, although there was some uncertainty over this. It could be potentially $60 billion larger. That's about it. It's not, in and of itself, it does little. It's a much more sensible structure, but that's about it. Now, the question is, what can these actually do? The fact is, neither of these, the EFSF can hardly fund itself. It had one of the best bond issues in early last year, I think it was 10 times covered. The demand was 10 times the actual supply of its first bond issue. Since then, it's had tremendous difficulty in funding itself. Meanwhile, the policyholders would like us to believe that they can rescue, but at the same time, we should continue to hold our bonds. But there's this problem of subordination. The problem of subordination is quite serious. I'd say for Portugal and Ireland it is, but it's as well for Italy and Spain. Because even though policymakers would like us to believe that Italy and Spain are liquidity issues, if it was truly a liquidity issue, they should be willing to lend and not get back their money until every bond is repaid. It doesn't work that way. The legal fine print and the what the policymakers say are completely disparate. And this is perhaps one of the largest parts of the credibility problem. They would like us to believe, for instance, that the rescue packages are pari passu with the bondholders. They're not. They're senior. And we've subordinated bondholders and reduced their potential claims as time goes on. They would like us to believe that they're committed to the EU project. At the same time, they keep their gold. They're not willing to commit it to some central repository. So there are tremendous problems with how Europe works because of this being of two minds in virtually everything. This leads us to actually the rather extreme scenario. Okay, and then the packages going forward. There are questions. There are many things that have been leaked about how they will potentially work. For instance, the ESM, the new facility. There's a question about whether it's going to be a preferred creditor. That's been, they've hemmed and hawed over that. If they were a preferred creditor, it could potentially trigger CDS. There's technical issues with that. But nonetheless, the fact that they've broached this topic is actually a pretty serious issue because every sort of dangerous idea that has come out in Europe has, even though they've backtracked, has come out once again. And so I'd like to leave it at that at Nomura, for instance, we tend to look at some of these more extreme scenarios because the decisions that policymakers have made tend to lead us more towards this extreme path. So I will leave it at that.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Let me thank all the speakers, and we can open now to questions from the audience. I think we need to then try to evaluate to what extent this is a political problem or something that can be dealt with in financial terms. But also we need to somehow discuss
whether there is a future, you know, with these PSI options, why are some options not taken, and what are the implications for Greece? But of course, we'll open up first to questions. Yomi.
No, as an economist, I get confused by the legal issues. And the two last speakers, they said something that caught my attention. They mentioned the fact that over 90% of Greek debt is issued in issued under Greek law, and then they talked about as the nuclear option. Now, this has been discussed recently, and this affects the game played by creditors. This affects the composition of creditors, and this makes the potential Greek default to be quite different than any other Greek any other default. Can you say something about why is this a nuclear option, and how does it affect, even though Greek might not exercise it, how does it affect the composition of creditors and the absence of vulture funds, et cetera, and this type of issues?
Why is it a nuclear option? Because, let's put it this way, the collective action clauses are not present in the Greek bonds. Now you have two options. Greece is going to pass a law saying that it's going to retrofit this. And certainly Greece does have the option to do that. Now, why should a country like Greece go to such a length in order to increase the participation, let's say, from 70 to 80 or to 90%, which is a very marginal increase in the or decrease in the borrowing costs, when they and cause a default, when they can go, as Nick said, they can go to Parliament and legislate and that all Greek bonds are zero coupon, 100,000 year maturity. It's the same thing. The end result would be exactly the same. It would be default and triggering. So why go with a nuclear option only to increase the participation from 90 to 100%? It just doesn't make sense. Why is it also a nuclear option? It's because for another thing, collective action clauses are supposed to, at least in international experience, to be used in good faith. In other words, you should not use the collective action clauses as a with colluding with some investors to defraud others. Let me just give you an example. I am a company and I got into serious trouble and I defaulted. And I've got a good friend here, Nick, and I said to Nick, why don't you go and buy 75% of my debt at 20 because it's defaulted, and then we can activate the collection the CACs and not pay the others, while I'm going to pay you back all the money. Now let's look at the Greek situation. All the Greek banks are going to get recapitalized from the issuer. Most of the European banks are going to get recapitalized from the EFSF to be the 100 billion that they're going to be there. The ECB is not going to participate. So hang on a second. All of these people who are going to vote for the CACs are going to be compensated one way or another by the issuer. Now, is this a good use of the collective action clauses? Who's going to be left out is going to be really crossed, saying, hang on a second, all of you guys who voted for the collective action clauses were recompensated one way or another by the issuer or by the EU. And I am a bondholder in China, and Merkel seems to be in China today trying to convince the Chinese to invest in Europe. And I'm going to get shafted because of the collective action clauses.
They're obviously bribing the banks to vote one way because they will recapitalize them. It's a type of bribe. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, usually when you have collective action clauses, you have these things called, if you buy back your own debt, you can't vote on it. It's a set of voting rights that are attached to each bond. But if your friend buys the debt, well, they can vote on it. And there is such a thought, Rodrigo would be able to tell us more, there's such a thought about intercreditor tortuous claims. I believe that unless it's incredibly fraudulent, you have absolutely no hope. I'm not saying it's moral, but it's done.
Basically, building on what both Andreas and Nick are saying, this is not a theoretical case. It happened in 2010 with one sovereign, Ecuador, where a president was campaigning to be reelected on non-servicing external debt. And when he was in office, he created a commission to audit the debt. By knowing who were the members of that commission, you will knew beforehand what would be the outcome. the outcome was that the debt was illegitimate. Illegal? No, illegitimate. Illegitimate encompasses moral aspects, social aspects. It's not a legal issue. And regarding the bonds, there were three series of bonds. They said all three of them are illegitimate. However, the government decided to default only on two of them. Why? Because the one in between was issued by the president when he was Minister of Finance. So his bond, he was servicing his bond. And in that occasion, they said, we cannot service the debt. Of course, the price of the debt dropped tremendously. It is alleged, there's no hard evidence, but it is, if you look at academic papers or you talk with people in the market, you will realize that that alleged nature is not so alleged, because they say that they have acquired the secondary markets 50% plus of the Ecuadorian debt, people that were acting on behalf of the Ecuadorian government. So you can replace, in your example, Nick by Ecuador to release him from any liability, and this is an actual case which happened in 2010.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you would like to add something on that. Any other questions, perhaps on less technical issues? Let me then sort of address the question that I pre-announced earlier, that some of the proposals definitely address, but also some of the things that Yeremin mentioned in the beginning, they require somebody to step in and refinance, sort of provide the cash for the repurchasing. And obviously that would have to be somebody very close to Europe, wouldn't allow Russia and China to help us out. So how would this work, and also how has it worked in other experiences, also in relation to international organizations? You know, how is this seen from outside?
If you do the calculation, then overall, the cash that is needed, overall, the cash that is needed, not now, but overall, would be about 120 billion. And this, I mean, the package that Greece is supposed to be receiving after the would be 130 billion. So certainly in terms of cash amount, in terms of the amount is there, whether it's going to get cash outright, it's very easy. What can happen is that the EFSF can actually exchange the bonds with T-bills that they have the right to exchange and to issue, and they can give to the bondholders who tender their bonds for cash, they can give them 3, 6, 9, 12 months or 15 months of T-bills in lieu of, you know, in and exchange the Greek bonds. And if in 10 months, let's say, the EFSF has not raised the cash to pay them, they can again give them another T-bill for another 3 months. So they can spread the cost of issuance. But the actual cost is exactly the same. The Greek package is 130 billion, and the cash offer is about 120. There may be 10 or 15 billion there, but who cares about 10, 15 billion nowadays?
Of course, the 130 billion is not there.
No, it's not there. It's conditional. Yes, of course.
Whereas in the proposal, they would have to pay cash.
In the proposal, it would say that we are doing this proposal now. Whether you know, you might actually get 120 or a 90 billion, because I'm saying that about 10% will hold out. That's about 20 billion. Now, the holdouts do not need to be paid immediately.
I'm actually gonna make a slightly different, a counter argument. Say potentially against. One of the positives of Andreas' proposal is that you do, of course, reduce the total debt stock. One of the negatives is you move all the PS, all the private investors, you move all the debt to the official side. Now, Greece, of course, is negotiating with the private investors, potentially hoping to pay off these new bonds. But there's a lot of debate about whether the new bonds are English law or Greek law. Greek would like as much flexibility as possible. As in, let's pay them some cash to keep them happy, but we'll pay some bonds and hopefully we'll pay them a couple coupons, but then we can restructure once again. By paying them all the cash now, we don't have that option. Now, unfortunately, there's very few bondholders left, so the official sector is probably going to have to take a hit at some point in the future, not necessarily in terms of a haircut, in terms of a reduction of the principal amount, but the extension and lowering of coupons, some other means of debt relief, just to ensure that Greece can...
In both cases, in both the PSI and the proposal, the you know, at least with the much of the proposals that I make is that that can be done through the official sector. In other words, without triggering or without doing anything, just bilateral agreements later on, you can actually negotiate an extension or moving the coupons in secret without actually affecting your standing as a country. So, and also you reduce the total debt stock, which basically means that your exit rating would be much higher than perhaps otherwise.
Just as a side note on why it is relevant to have Greek or English law, the main difference why all this discussion is that if the bonds are governed by Greek law, they can be amended, retrofitted, extended, halved by means of a Greek law, an act of the executive, or just a presidential decree, an executive decree of the prime minister, or by the Congress. While if there are bonds governed by a different law, that means non-Greek, those cannot be easily amended. That's why many of the creditors feel more secure with a bond governed by English law.
In fact, we've generally seen that English law bonds have traded a premium to Greek law bonds. They already have these collective action clauses in, but there are bondholders who are likely have positions in them to prevent them being restructured. It's either that or they manage to hold credit CDS protection against that. Irrespective, there are very few of them that trade, they're quite illiquid, and there are many reasons to prefer them over Greek debt because just merely because of this issue.
And the total debt in foreign law is about 6.9% of the total bond stock. So you would expect at least these, if the holders are non-Greek, to hold out. But this is a sort of a small amount compared to the holdout of the ECB.
Is there an international experience on repatriating? Obviously, Greece is a special case because there is somebody to provide the money for repatriating. But is in the sort of historically in the cases of distress and defaults, has this option of repatriating been exercised, or is it something that we just imagine that it can be a possibility?
For sure, the Philippines. At least, you know, we heard about the repurchasing debt. You know, it was supposedly Reglingham who initially pushed this, and he was at the IMF during the Philippines. I don't know.
No, historically, the buybacks have not worked very well, really. And the reason is that they also create a big holdout problem of sorts, right? So as you buy back the debt, to the extent that this does help the country reduce its debt, the price of the debt goes up in the secondary market, and so you end up basically the creditors appropriate a large fraction of the efficiency gain from the reduction in the debt burden. Now, in the particular scheme that Andreas mentioned, the buyback would be financed through debt that is owed to a senior creditor. And that keeps the price, tends to keep the price down. Nonetheless, there's still a significant holdout problem. So it's still the case that, you know, the March bondholders would not buy this, no?
First of all, it's not exactly a repurchase. It's just another option alongside the other bond. So you just offer the bond, the 20-year bond, with a 50%, or the option to actually cash out. So it's not exactly a repurchase option.
So
the holdouts, as I said, would be limited, first of all, to the foreign law, which is about 18 billion or a lot less than that, and then the near maturities. Now, if you actually look at the near maturities, there are at least this year maturing 34 billion worth of bonds.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't go beyond
on this is based on your original question whether there has been a successful buyback. I agree with Jeremy that the short answer is no. However, Ecuador, which was an opportunistic default, they have the resources. They say they, to some extent, manipulated the price, acquired the debt, obtained more than 50%, launched an exchange offer. The degree of participation was very high because they already held 50%+ of the total percentage. That can be seen as one. And on the second issue is Andreas is talking about a 10-12% holdout as a minimum thing. I'm slightly more skeptical because I fear creditors building what is known as a blocking holding, which can freeze one of the series of the bonds and that can trigger the collapse of a transaction. It has happened in the past, and of course, I don't want to increase the risk or kind of sell a ghost to the audience because litigation at the end of the day, it's a very small percentage. It is a very small percentage, and I personally think that it's not significant if we take into account the number of series of bonds out there and how many, even within those that have been in distress, default, or restructuring, the amount of successful litigation is still very low.
Can I maybe say one more thing on this? So I find your numbers actually quite plausible. So we have, I've done with a co-author a similar calculation where we looked at the chances that a small creditor who can free ride if he or she wants to would find it attractive to take a voluntary exchange offer involving a seniority upgrade to English law like you have, but only with a 15 cents on the dollar cash out, right? And so in those circumstances, roughly speaking, if you think that the chances that there will be another Greek restructuring are in the order of 50% or higher, so that be having that English law bond or not being called as the only one with a Greek law bond is really worth something, right? It ensures you de facto seniority. That combined with the 15 cents on the dollar or the euro will induce you to take a 50% face value haircut. So you can kind of play with numbers and this is what comes out. Now, the critical assumption that drives this is this notion that this is not the next, that this is not the end of the story, right? There's still sovereign risk, and in this future restructuring, you would be better protected. And so then the question is, you know, what is the time span over which another second restructuring is plausible with 50% probability? Okay? And so obviously, they're not, if they have just done a large debt exchange, they're not going to fault again in the next 4 weeks, right? But say within a year. So if you then assume that, you know, after a year is the kind of time that you can be safe, then that roughly gives you the amount of debt that would hold out, and that's about twice as much as the amount of debt that you name. So we would, in our idea, the holdouts would be about 20%, but that's natural because we are paying them only 15 cents on the euro, whereas you are paying them 30 cents on the euro. Now, the difference between these two ideas, which are intellectually very close, is that in our thought experiment, this can be financed out of the existing official package, right? Whereas you need extra cash, right? And this is essentially where you have to take a view whether we are, you know, whether this is in the cards at this point or not. No, because I mean, remember that the 130 billion is not straight financing to the Greek state, right? It's supposed to make sure that Greece doesn't have to go back to the markets, but it is primarily balance of payments financing. Right? It has to deal with a large current account deficit that Greece is still running within the European Union. And so if you factor in the money that you need, basically the 130 billion assumes a 50 cents on the dollar payout, right? If you want to go to 30 cents, you need more money, right? It's going to be more expensive.
The 15 cents would also happen with the 2-year EFSF bond. At least that was the idea that was floated around. It's not going to be a cash payout. So this is quite similar.
top left.
Hey, a couple of comments on Andreas' proposal. First of all, I definitely agree that about the collective action clause as being cowboy behavior. And I also very much agree that the PSI that you point out would probably be better for Greece. And also the idea of the ECB not booking a profit, I think would also help sustainability. But I think the key point that you're addressing is that the PSI is not that was designed was not really for Greece. It was partly for political reasons to show that private sector was participating. And secondly, it was a deal that wasn't too bad for the banks. So the key point that I think all of you have failed to address is that if the banks at the moment are not willing to accept a 50% nominal haircut, and you see some creditors are walking away when there was a discussion of NPV losses of more than 50%, and now we're talking about NPV of 70%, then why would they accept a deal that you're proposing where they have a 70% haircut in nominal terms? That's the first thing that you have to address. The second thing is the way the bank's balance sheets worked. A lot of this stuff is a very low risk weighting, especially for the European banks. So straight away, the banks would have to straight away put this down to equity. And secondly, where the provisions are for the banking sector are provisions around where the PSI is at the moment. So if they were to take a 70% haircut, as you're saying, then you'd need much greater capital needs for the rest of the Eurozone. And that's not to mention the contagion effects you probably have on Portugal and any of the other countries. And finally, a couple of technical points before I come to my main one, is that the... I'll shut up soon, I promise. The offer they have at the moment does include a component of cash, as I understand it. There's apparently going to be 15% cash and around 35% of additional bonds. So there is some cash, which is partly what you're saying. And the second thing is you mentioned something about not getting English law involved. That seemed a bit of a contradiction with the CAC's point. I thought the idea of having English law for the new bonds is a great idea, because then it avoids the potential retroactive points. And the very, very final point is on a moral hazard issue. If you do the proposal you're saying and Greece goes down to debt of 100% to GDP, this will put it below Italy and below where Portugal will come out of the package. So that comes back to a point that the guy from Nomura was saying, that if you do such a great deal for Greece, the voters in Italy and Portugal will say, hold on a minute, we want some of this. So the PSI is actually designed, like I said at the start, for political reasons. So the reason they want them to come out 120% in 2020 is so the Greeks feel the pain, the markets get soothed, and none of the other countries want any of it.
Quite a few points, but let me take another point from the gentleman.
And then you. Hi, I'm the guy who did most of the slides. So first of all, Mr. Kudra's offer is actually better for the banks, because the NPV of the current Greek deal is going to be below 30, and also his offer is going to involve more cash. Dr. Zedelmayr put it very eloquently with the issue of the current account, but it's another reason it's going to cost much more. Anyways, actually, I want to make a question that actually matters to the people here besides the technical thing, and I want to make it to the legal expert. So there have been, which is the exposure on the future litigation of Greece. Argentina is still in the courts. One co-author of Mr. Zedelmayr has found a lot of exposures that Greece might have. One is the Human Rights Convention, the other is the Greek Constitution. I don't care about those. One is the bilateral investment treaties. Greece has 43 of those. Argentina is still in the courts for the bilateral investment treaty between Italy. And I don't think it has cost them anything, but they are still there. The other issue, which could be a huge risk, I don't know if it's a huge risk, is the... You said there could be some holdouts. The holdouts will be on the foreign law bonds, because that's where you can have a stake. In the other one, it will be an aggregate. So there will be holdouts, let's say, in the foreign law bonds. Can these people claim on the pari passu an attachment of payments from the European loans or anything like that? Can they stop it, as Elliot did with Peru in 2002?
2000.
Yeah, 2000, yeah. It happened many times after that. The Belgian courts agreed to it. Other courts have agreed to it. Will Greece be liable to this? This will be a huge risk for Greece in the future. I don't know, I'm not a lawyer. It's something I have always wondered.
Let's keep it there.
Okay, but I think personally, all these technical details with the numbers and the stuff don't matter to Greek people. I mean, the real issue is the future litigation risk. Mm.
There was another question in the gentleman in the fifth row.
Let's make it around the answer.
Before the answer, can I add something to kind of comment up there and basically see how?
I agree in the fact that it would be, if you were a creditor, if you were a creditor, why would you accept? We have covered some of the issues as to, there are two options, accept a 50% haircut, or we will pay you in full, which is already something that will, I'm being a hedge fund, I will not be excited about that. And on top of that, we will be facing another restructuring, or there are serious chances of a second round of restructuring on the same instrument. And I really think that we still haven't seen the proper sweeteners on the deal, which are some additional contractual provisions, like, for instance, restatement of principal, which is a provision that we have seen in previous restructurings, that in the event that you accept a haircut, and it happens that in 3, 5, X number of years down the road, you need to do a second restructuring because you cannot service your debt, that principal that you have accepted in the first restructuring is restated on the bond. So I think that if I am a hedge fund and I'm going to accept a 50% haircut, I will need to have some additional incentives which do not necessarily cause to the transaction, but that can help increase the degree of participation, not using cash, and this is where I mean there are some other voluntary elements that we can add into the picture to increase the participation without triggering CACs, for example. That was, so before you answer that bit, I wanted to add.
Just a quick comment on why should banks accept this offer. First of all, most, if not all, European banks have actually marked their bonds at 50 after the European Council decision on the 26th of October. Most of them actually have marked them below that. I know banks have marked them at 20 now. And if they are offered 30, they would make a gain. We're not talking about hedge funds. We're not talking about pension funds. We're talking about banks. The most of the RBS, for example, marked them, I think, at 30-something just last year, most of the Greek bonds. It was announced. So because it was a EU Council decision. Now, perhaps there may be some banks who have them still at 100, and in that case, it would be a loss for them. But most of them, in fact, I think most of them, as far as I know, have marked them at least 50 or below. One of the biggest bondholders, which I know for sure, has marked them at 22. Okay, so the incentive to actually participate in a bond exchange where they get 50 plus 15%, well, sorry, they get 50% cut, and they get 15% in cash plus a 30-year or 20-year bond with a Greek restructuring risk straight away, if they have that choice or take 30 cents out and be done with the Greek risk forever, I mean, any rational person would actually say, I'll take the 30 cents and not deal with the Greece again for the next 20 years. And this actually, with regards to the law, the English law, I'm not saying that there's not going to be an English law. All I'm saying is that you limit the application because you only have few people choosing the 20-year Greek bond with under English law because you prefer the 20. Yes, you would have some, but you're not going to have the majority of it in English law. And after all, the bilateral loans are under English law anyway. But this is a bilateral loan, not something that goes to the freely tradable, at least as right now, as it is. So you actually limit. You don't completely eliminate, but you actually contain some of the legal risk.
Would you like to respond to the issue of contagion and how a sort of an appealing offer for Greece would make them the Italian and Portugal?
I mean, it would, but you know, actually, I'm actually more interested in Rodrigo's answer about litigation risk.
How many minutes do we have?
One.
Litigation risk, I personally think it's very high. It's inevitable, it will happen, it will be extensive litigation. I don't think that it will be only circumscribed to UK debt instruments. Some of the hedge funds, they try to drive the debtor crazy, and they attack them in every possible front. So when you're saying we should focus on UK, yes, that I think should be their main strategy, but I will not discount up front that they will not litigate in Greece as well.
So in Greece, it has to be, all Greek law bonds have to be decided by Greek courts.
What usually happens, and here's where politics come into the picture, is that in some of the, so far we've been dealing with developing countries. Now we are dealing with developed countries. And in developing countries, the respect for the rule of law is not as such as in developed countries. Greece being part of the EU, having, I personally think, a higher standard. If this had happened in Argentina, again, I refer to Latin America, where they, during the 80s, 90s, there were hundreds of restructurings. Argentina, Ecuador, Peru. It's very simple to pass a law. Basically, we said, sorry guys, we are in a state of emergency. Sorry guys, this is a crisis. There's a state of necessity. And as such, for example, during the Argentine crisis, we converted your deposits in US dollars into Argentine pesos at a rate that we decided. And don't dare to go to court because I said it's a state of emergency. Therefore, some of the courts started kind of a rebellion against the government. So the government increased the number of judges in the Supreme Court from 5 to 9, so they have a majority. So any case could have been overturned in second instance, but then when it reached Supreme Court, how many vote against it? Oh, we have majority. So that's why I personally think that under Greek law, it would be more difficult. But what I'm saying is, I personally think if I were in the shoes of a hedge fund, I would also use that as another technique to drive them crazy. Because that's what has been happening with Argentina. They have been litigating everywhere. When I mean everywhere, New York, Germany, Japan, Italy. With Argentina, they were litigating against the Bank of International Settlement in Switzerland. They are litigating through bilateral investment treaties at ICSID.
Can I say something on this? So just one caveat to what Rodrigo said, which I agree with for the most part. I think that in order for this type of aggressive, you know, driving crazy strategy to make commercial sense for a distressed debt fund, they have to be able to buy the debt at a very low price. Okay, it is a very risky approach. And the Greek case cuts both ways in this regard. So on the one hand, yes, they are in the EU, which presumably makes litigation easier. On the other hand, I don't think that, you know, institutions in Greece generally work that well or that quickly. So the idea of spending the next 10 years in court litigating under Greek law is not a terribly attractive idea. And for that reason, I think that there will probably be a threshold where it makes sense to buy Greek debt for the purposes of going that, but it's probably quite low. And this is, I think, the main reason why you want to be, I mean, reasonable, right? I mean, this, I think, answers also the point about, you know, why is it unattractive to exercise the nuclear option? I think this is the answer to the very first question of the evening, because if you exercise the nuclear option and really use the full power that you have, that under Greek law, you would be creating a very large group holdouts, disgruntled holdouts that will go after you. But the threshold for that to happen is quite low. And my sort of rule of thumb is you want to stay clearly above Argentina territory on the haircut. And as long as you do that, you will probably be okay. So it sort of, there is a range there of the maximum amount that you can get through this PSI, which I think is not going to be more than 60 or 70 percent NPV, even though Greece would need more, okay? But the reason is that if you go above 70%, then you're really in litigation nightmare territory. And so the way this, in my view, this whole thing is going to play out is that the official sector is pushing Greece to go right up to that limit, okay? But I don't think they will go over that limit. And once they then have gotten as much money out of the private sector as they can, subject to avoiding the litigation nightmare, there will, of course, this will not be enough debt relief on the whole for Greece, and then the rest of the game will be essentially a distributional problem between the official sector and the Greek. Greek taxpayer. So more official sector support or more Greek consolidation efforts.
Maybe I can make a point, because Dimitris actually raised another important point about litigation. It had to do with potentially attaching for foreign law bondholders using pari passu clauses to attach to payments. Is that something that I know it has been done, and especially because they're not made to the IMF, they're made to the EU, they're made to the EFSF, a private corporation in Luxembourg.
So could you explain to other people why it's important? Because this can stop Greece the ability to pay anything. So it might force Greece to default properly.
Can I ask this to be the last response? We're well past our advertised time, so we have to release the audience, and then we can continue if you want.
I'm happy to answer if you want. Like, we can do it bilaterally, but okay. Basically, the pari passu clause. The problem that you have is that there are two possible interpretations of the clause. One is the narrow interpretation, and the other one is the broad interpretation. Broad interpretation says that if you pay someone, you should also pay me, which is a kind of looking at the pari passu clause as a sharing clause. With that interpretation, I personally think it's wrong, it's the wrong one. But at the end of the day, the problem with the pari passu clause, and here I will quote Lee Buhai, it's short, obscure, and sports a little bit of Latin. All features that lawyers found endearing. It's a clause that I read a book, Jeromin's co-author, Mitu Gulati, wrote a short book on the pari passu clause. And he bothered to interview more or less 200 practitioners, and none of them have a clear understanding of what's the purpose, what's the interpretation of the clause. Each one has a different view. And that's true, and that's what happened in courts. In the year 2000, in a Belgian court, they said, yes, this is a sharing clause. And that's how they stopped payments from Peru to service newly restructured bonds. So Peru was in the dilemma, either I pay this angry creditor, who end up making a gain of 400%, Elliot, or I default on the newly issued debt as a result of a restructuring exercise. Trying to give you an answer to that, I personally think that we will be faced with interpretation of the pari passu clause under UK law with English judges. The case of Belgium was a judge sitting in Belgium ruling on English law. So the familiarity of an English judge on English law, I personally think that it will, interpreting the clause as a sharing clause, I personally think that would be, I'm not saying it's impossible, I think it would be slightly far-stretched. And here, another disclaimer, I'm not giving legal advice. I'm just providing my blue sky thinking on what would be the possible interpretation. There are many other elements that you should consider, but which are very technical, that we can discuss afterwards privately.
Okay. I think, just the last comment, I think the question of the English law, I mean, this is 18 billion or 6.9% of the total bonds outstanding. I mean, Greece could actually go and buy these bonds or even pay these bonds out. It's not a significant number, you know, to be having legal problems for the next 30 years. In fact, I'm surprised they haven't done that already. You know, they just provide the money to buy these bonds and destroy them. So I think the question would be, if an angry creditor go to the Greek High Court, and of course he's going to get there shown, you know what, but can they go afterwards and into some sort of higher European court and claim, which claims to have European Court of Justice that overrules the Greek court? That is the question that I want to know.
Okay, let's treat this as a rhetorical question, not provide an answer. On this note, thanks everybody for the participation, and most of all, thank the speaker for the very
There's a door here that locks after 6:30, so I cannot get out.